What are we doing here? Julian wondered as he followed the Guardia out onto the viewing esplanade at the base of the mountain, beneath the cross. This is where my father wants to meet? Walking beside him, Valdespino looked equally confused. This makes no sense, he whispered. Your father always despised this place. Millions despise this place, Julian thought. Conceived in 1940 by Franco himself, the Valley of the Fallen had been billed as a national act of atonement, an attempt to reconcile victors and vanquished. Despite its noble aspiration, the monument sparked controversy to this day because it was built by a workforce that included convicts and political prisoners who had opposed Franco, many of whom died from exposure and starvation during construction. In the past, some parliamentary members had even gone so far as to compare this place to a Nazi concentration camp. Julian suspected his father secretly felt the same way, even if he could never say so openly. For most Spaniards, the site was regarded as a monument to Franco, built by Franco, a colossal shrine to honor himself. The fact that Franco was now entombed in it only added fuel to the critic's fire. Julian recalled the one time he had been here, another childhood outing with his father to learn about his country. The king had shown him around and quietly whispered, "Look carefully, son. One day, you'll tear this down." Now, as Julian followed the Guardia up the stairs toward the austere facade carved into the mountainside, he began to realize where they were going. A sculpted bronze door loomed before them, a portal into the face of the mountain itself, and Julian recalled stepping through that door as a boy, utterly transfixed by what lay beyond. After all, the true miracle of this mountaintop was not the towering cross above it. The true miracle was the secret space inside it. Hollowed out within the granite peak was a man-made cavern of unfathomable proportions. The hand-excavated cavern tunneled back nearly 900 feet into the mountain, where it opened up into a gaping chamber, meticulously and elegantly finished, with glimmering tile floors and a soaring frescoed cupola that spanned nearly 150 feet from side to side. "I'm inside a mountain," young Julian had thought. "I must be dreaming." Now, years later, Prince Julian had returned, here, at the behest of my dying father. As the group neared the iron portal, Julian gazed up at the austere bronze Pietà above the door. Beside him, Bishop Valdespino crossed himself, although Julian sensed the gesture was more out of trepidation than faith. Chapter 82. ConspiracyNet.com. Breaking news. But who is the regent? Evidence has now surfaced proving that assassin Luis Avila was taking his kill orders directly from an individual he called the regent. The identity of the regent remains a mystery, although this person's title may provide some clues. According to Dictionary.com, a regent is someone appointed to oversee an organization while its leader is incapacitated or absent. From our user survey, "Who is the regent?", our top three answers currently are 1. Bishop Antonio Valdespino, taking over for the ailing Spanish king. 2. A Palmerian pope who believes he is the legitimate pontiff. 3. A Spanish military officer claiming to be acting on behalf of his country's incapacitated commander-in-chief, the king. More news as we have it. Hashtag, who is the regent? Chapter 83. Langdon and Ambra scanned the facade of the large chapel and found the entrance to the Barcelona Supercomputing Center at the southern tip of the church's nave. Here, an ultra-modern plexiglass vestibule had been affixed to the outside of the rustic facade, giving the church the hybrid appearance of a building caught between centuries. In an outer courtyard near the entrance, stood a 12-foot-tall bust of a primitive warrior's head. Langdon couldn't imagine what this artifact was doing on the grounds of a Catholic church, but he was fairly certain, knowing Edmund, that Kirsch's workplace would be a land of contradictions. Ambra hurried to the main entrance and pressed the call button at the door. As Langdon joined her, a security camera overhead rotated toward them, scanning back and forth for several long moments. Then the door buzzed open. Langdon and Ambra quickly pushed through the entrance into a large foyer that was fashioned from the church's original narthex. It was an enclosed stone chamber, dimly lit and empty. Langdon had expected someone would appear to greet them, perhaps one of Edmund's employees, but the lobby was deserted.
"Is there no one here?" Ambra whispered.
They became aware of the soft, pious strains of medieval church music, a polyphonic choral work for male voices that sounded vaguely familiar. Langdon couldn't place it, but the eerie presence of religious music in a high-tech facility seemed to him a product of Edmund's playful sense of humor. Glowing in front of them on the wall of the lobby, a massive plasma screen provided the room's sole light. The screen was projecting what could only be described as some kind of primitive computer game, clusters of black dots moving around on a white surface like groups of bugs wandering aimlessly. Not totally aimlessly, Langdon realized, now recognizing the patterns. This famous computer-generated progression, known as life, had been invented in the 1970s by a British mathematician, John Conway. The black dots, known as cells, moved, interacted, and reproduced based on a preordained series of rules entered by the programmer. Invariably, over time, guided only by these initial rules of engagement, the dots began organizing themselves into clusters, sequences, and recurring patterns. Patterns that evolved, became more complex, and began to look startlingly similar to patterns seen in nature.
"Conway's Game of Life," Ambra said. "I saw a digital installation years ago based on it, a mixed media piece titled Cellular Automaton."
Langdon was impressed, having heard of life himself only because its inventor, Conway, had taught at Princeton. The choral harmonies caught Langdon's ear again.
"I feel like I've heard this piece.
Perhaps a Renaissance Mass?"
"Robert," Ambra said, pointing. "Look."
On the display screen, the bustling groups of dots had reversed direction and were accelerating, as if the program were now playing backward. The sequence rewound faster and faster, backward in time. The number of dots began diminishing, the cells no longer splitting and multiplying, but recombining, their structures becoming simpler and simpler until finally there were only a handful of them, which continued merging. First 8, then 4, then 2, then 1. A single cell blinked in the middle of the screen. Langdon felt a chill. The origin of life. The dot blinked out, leaving only a void, an empty white screen. The game of life was gone, and faint text began to materialize, growing more pronounced until they could read it. "If we admit a first cause, the mind still craves to know whence it came and how it arose."
"That's Darwin,"
Langdon whispered, recognizing the legendary botanist's eloquent phrasing of the same question Edmund Kirsch had been asking.
"Where do we come from?"
Ambra said excitedly, reading the text. "Exactly." Ambra smiled at him.
"Shall we go find out?"
She motioned beside the display screen to a columned opening that appeared to connect to the main church. As they stepped across the lobby, the display refreshed again, now showing a collage of words that appeared randomly on the screen. The number of words grew steadily and chaotically, with new words evolving, morphing, and combining into an intricate array of phrases, growth, fresh buds, beautiful ramifications. As the image expanded, Langdon and Ambra saw the words evolve into the shape of a growing tree. What in the world? They stared intently at the graphic, and the sound of the a cappella voices grew louder around them. Langdon realized that they were not singing in Latin, as he had imagined, but in English.
My God! The words on this screen, Ambra said. I think they match the music.
You're right, Langdon agreed, seeing fresh text appear on screen as it was being sung simultaneously. By slowly acting causes, not by miraculous acts. Langdon listened and watched, feeling strangely disconcerted by the combination of words and music. The music was clearly religious, yet the text was anything but. Organic beings, strongest live, weakest die. Langdon stopped short.
I know this piece.
Edmund had taken Langdon to a performance of it several years ago. Titled Missa Charles Darwin, it was a Christian-style mass in which the composer had eschewed the traditional sacred Latin text and substituted excerpts from Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species to create a haunting juxtaposition of devout voices singing about the brutality of natural selection. Bizarre, Langdon commented. Edmund and I heard this piece together a while back. He loved it. Such a coincidence to hear it again. No coincidence, boomed a familiar voice from the speakers overhead. Edmund taught me to welcome guests into my home by putting on some music they would appreciate and showing them something of interest to discuss. Langdon and Ambra stared up at the speakers in disbelief. The cheerful voice that welcomed them was distinctly British.
I'm so glad you found your way here, said the very familiar synthetic voice. I had no way to contact you.
Winston! Langdon exclaimed, amazed to feel such relief from reconnecting with a machine. He and Ambra quickly recounted what had happened.
It's good to hear your voices, Winston said. So, tell me, have we found what we were looking for?
Chapter 84 William Blake, Langdon said. The dark religions are departed and sweet science reigns. Winston paused only an instant.
The final line of his epic poem, The Four Zoas. I must admit it's a perfect choice.
He paused.
However, the requisite 47-letter count...
The ampersand, Langdon said, quickly explaining Kirsch's ligature trick using E.T.
That is quintessential Edmund.
The synthetic voice replied with an awkward chuckle.
So, Winston, Ambra urged, now that you know Edmund's password, can you trigger the remainder of his presentation?
Of course I can, Winston replied unequivocally. All I need is for you to enter the password manually. Edmund placed firewalls around this project, so I don't have direct access to it. But I can take you back to his lab and show you where to enter the information. We can launch the program in less than 10 minutes. Langdon and Ambra turned to each other, the abruptness of Winston's confirmation catching them off guard. With everything they had endured tonight, this ultimate moment of triumph seemed to have arrived without any fanfare.
Robert, Ambra whispered, placing a hand on his shoulder. You did this. Thank you.
Team effort, he replied with a smile.
Might I suggest, Winston said, that we move immediately back to Edmund's lab? You're quite visible here in the lobby, and I've detected some news reports that you are in this vicinity.
Langdon was not surprised. A military helicopter touching down in a metropolitan park was bound to draw attention.
Tell us where to go, Ambra said.
Between the columns, Winston replied. Follow my voice. In the lobby, the choral music stopped abruptly. The plasma screen went dark, and from the main entrance a series of loud thuds echoed as automatically controlled deadbolts engaged. Edmund probably turned this facility into a fortress, Langdon realized, stealing a quick glance through the thick lobby windows, relieved to see that the wooded area around the chapel was deserted, at least for the moment. As he turned back toward Umbra, he saw a light flicker on at the end of the lobby, illuminating a doorway between two columns. He and Umbra walked over, entered, and found themselves in a long corridor. More lights flickered at the far end of the hallway, guiding their way. As Langdon and Umbra set off down the hall, Winston told them, "I believe that to achieve maximum exposure, we need to disseminate a global press release right now saying that the late Edmund Kirsch's presentation is about to go live. If we give the media an extra window to publicize the event, it will increase Edmund's viewership dramatically."
"Interesting idea," Umbra said, striding faster. "But how long do you think we should wait? I don't want to take any chances."
17 minutes, Winston replied. "That would place the broadcast at the top of the hour, 3 a.m. here and prime time across America."
"Perfect," she replied.
"Very well," Winston chimed. "The media release will go out right now, and the presentation launch will be in 17 minutes. Langdon strained to keep up with Winston's rapid-fire planning. Umbra led the way down the hall.
"And how many staff members are here tonight?"
"None," Winston replied. "Edmund was fanatical about security. There is virtually no staff here. I run all the computer networks along with lighting, cooling, and security. Edmund joked that in this era of smart houses, he was the first to have a smart church." Langdon was only half listening, his thoughts consumed by sudden concerns over the actions they were about to take. "Winston, do you really think now is the moment to release Edmund's presentation?" Umbra stopped short and stared at him.
"Robert, of course it is. That's why we're here. The whole world is watching. We also don't know if anyone else will come and try to stop us. We need to do this now, before it's too late."
"I concur," Winston said. "From a strictly statistical standpoint, this story is approaching its saturation point. Measured in terabytes of media data, the Edmund Kirsch discovery is now one of the biggest news stories of the decade. Not surprising, considering how the online community has grown exponentially in the past 10 years.
"Robert?"
Umbra pressed, her eyes probing his.
"What's your concern?"
Langdon hesitated, trying to pinpoint the source of his sudden uncertainty. "I guess I'm just worried for Edmund's sake that all of the conspiracy stories tonight—murders, kidnapping, royal intrigue—will somehow overshadow his science."
"That's a valid point, Professor," Winston interjected.
"Although I believe it overlooks one important fact. Those conspiracy stories are a significant reason why so many viewers all over the world are now tuned in. There were 3.8 million during Edmund's online broadcast earlier this evening. But now, after all the dramatic events of the last several hours, I estimate that some 200 million people are following this story through online news reports, social media, television, and radio." The number seemed staggering to Langdon, although he recalled that more than 200 million people had watched the FIFA World Cup final and 500 million had watched the first lunar landing a half century ago, when nobody had internet and televisions were far less widespread globally.
"You may not see this in academia, Professor," Winston said, "but the rest of the world has become a reality TV show. Ironically, the people who tried to silence Edmund tonight have accomplished the opposite. Edmund now has the largest audience for any scientific announcement in history. It reminds me of the Vatican denouncing your book, Christianity and the Sacred Feminine, which, in the aftermath, promptly became a bestseller."
Almost a bestseller, Langdon thought, but Winston's point was taken.
"Maximizing viewership was always one of Edmund's primary goals tonight," Winston said.
"He's right," Ambra said, looking at Langdon.
When Edmund and I brainstormed the live Guggenheim event, he was obsessed with increasing audience engagement and capturing as many eyeballs as possible.
As I said, Winston stressed, we are reaching our point of media saturation, and there is no better time than the present to unveil his discovery. Understood, Langdon said. Just tell us what to do. Continuing down the hallway, they arrived at an unexpected obstacle. A ladder awkwardly propped across the corridor as if for a painting job, making it impossible to advance without moving the ladder or passing beneath it.
This ladder, Langdon offered. Shall I take it down?
No, Winston said. Edmund deliberately put it there a long time ago.
Why? Ambra asked.
As you may know, Edmund despised superstition in all forms. He made a point of walking under a ladder every day on his way into work, a way of thumbing his nose at the gods. Moreover, if any guest or technician refused to walk under this ladder, Edmund kicked them out of the building.
Always so reasonable. Langdon smiled, recalling how Edmund had once berated him in public for knocking on wood for luck.
Robert, unless you're a closet druid who still raps on trees to wake them up, please leave that ignorant superstition in the past where it belongs.
Ambra pressed on, ducking down and walking beneath the ladder. With an admittedly irrational twinge of trepidation, Langdon followed suit. When they reached the other side, Winston guided them around a corner to a large security door that had two cameras and a biometric scan. A handmade sign hung above the door. Room 13. Langdon eyed the infamously unlucky number. Edmund, spurning the gods once again.
This is the entrance to his lab, Winston said. Other than the hired technicians who helped Edmund build it, very few have been permitted access.
With that, the security door buzzed loudly, and Ambra wasted no time grabbing the handle and heaving it open. She took one step over the threshold, stopped short, and raised her hand to her mouth with a startled gasp. When Langdon looked past her into the church's sanctuary, he understood her reaction. The chapel's voluminous hall was dominated by the largest glass box Langdon had ever seen. The transparent enclosure spanned the entire floor and reached all the way up to the chapel's two-story ceiling. The box seemed to be divided into two floors. On the first floor, Langdon could see hundreds of refrigerator-sized metal cabinets aligned in rows like church pews facing an altar. The cabinets had no doors, and their innards were on full display. Mind-bogglingly intricate matrices of bright red wires dangled from dense grids of contact points, arching down toward the floor where they were laced together into thick, rope-like harnesses that ran between the machines, creating what looked like a web of veins.
Ordered chaos, Langdon thought.
On the first floor, Winston said, you see the famous Mare Nostrum supercomputer. 48,896 Intel cores communicating over an InfiniBand FDR-10 network. One of the fastest machines in the world. Mare Nostrum was here when Edmund moved in, and rather than removing it, he wanted to incorporate it, so he simply expanded upward.
Langdon could now see that all of Mare Nostrum's wire harnesses merged at the center of the room, forming a single trunk that climbed vertically like a massive vine into the first floor's ceiling. As Langdon's gaze rose to the second story of the huge glass rectangle, he saw a totally different picture. Here, in the center of the floor, on a raised platform, stood a massive metallic blue-gray cube, 10 feet square, with no wires, no blinking lights, and nothing about it to suggest it could possibly be the cutting-edge computer that Winston was currently describing with barely decipherable terminology.
Qubits replace binary digits, superpositions of states, quantum algorithms,
entanglement and tunneling. Langdon now knew why he and Edmund talked art rather than computing, resulting in quadrillions of floating-point calculations per second, Winston concluded, making the fusion of these two very different machines the most powerful supercomputer in the world.
My God, Umbra whispered.
Actually, Winston corrected, Edmund's God. Chapter 85. ConspiracyNet.com. Breaking news. Kirsch discovery to air within minutes. Yes, it's really happening. A press release from Edmund Kirsch's camp has just confirmed that his widely anticipated scientific discovery, withheld in the wake of the futurist's assassination, will be streamed live to the world at the top of the hour, 3 a.m. local time in Barcelona. Viewer participation is reportedly skyrocketing, and global online engagement statistics are unprecedented. In related news, Robert Langdon and Ambra Vidal were allegedly just spotted entering the grounds of Chapel Torre Girona, home to the Barcelona Supercomputing Center, where Edmund Kirsch is believed to have been working for the past several years. Whether this is the site from which the presentation will be live-streamed, ConspiracyNet cannot yet confirm. Stay tuned for Kirsch's presentation, available here as a live stream on ConspiracyNet.com. Chapter 86. As Prince Julian passed through the iron doorway into the mountain, he had the uneasy feeling that he might never escape. The Valley of the Fallen. What am I doing here? The space beyond the threshold was cold and dark, barely illuminated by two electric torches. The air smelled of damp stone. A uniformed man stood before them holding a loop of keys that jangled in his trembling hands. Julian was not surprised that this officer of the Patrimonio Nacional seemed anxious. A half-dozen Guardia Real agents were lined up right behind him in the darkness. My father is here. No doubt this poor officer had been summoned in the middle of the night to unlock Franco's sacred mountain for the king. One of the Guardia agents quickly stepped forward.
Prince Julian, Bishop Valdespino, we've been expecting you. This way, please.
The Guardia agent led Julian and Valdespino to a massive wrought iron gate on which was carved an ominous Francoist symbol, a fierce, double-headed eagle that echoed Nazi iconography.
His Majesty is at the end of the tunnel, the agent said, motioning them through the gate, which had been unlocked and stood partially ajar.
Julian and the bishop exchanged uncertain glances and walked through the gate, which was flanked by a pair of menacing metal sculptures, two angels of death clutching swords shaped like crosses. More Francoist religio-military imagery, Julian thought, as he and the bishop began their long walk into the mountain. The tunnel that stretched out before them was as elegantly appointed as the ballroom of Madrid's royal palace, with finely polished black marble floors and a soaring coffered ceiling. The sumptuous passageway was lit by a seemingly endless series of wall sconces shaped like torches. Tonight, however, the source of light in the passageway was far more dramatic. Dozens upon dozens of fire basins, dazzling bowls of fire arranged like runway lights, burned orange all the way down the tunnel. Traditionally, these fires were lit only for major events, but the late-night arrival of the king apparently ranked high enough to set them all aglow. With reflections of firelight dancing on the burnished floor, the massive hallway took on an almost supernatural ambiance. Julian could feel the ghostly presence of those sad souls who had carved this tunnel by hand, their pickaxes and shovels poised, toiling for years inside this cold mountain, hungry, frozen, many dying, all for the glorification of Franco, whose tomb lay deep within this mountain.
Look carefully, son, his father had told him. One day you'll tear this down.
As king, Julian knew he would probably not have the power to destroy this magnificent structure, and yet he had to admit he felt surprised that the people of Spain had permitted it to stand, especially considering the country's eagerness to move past her dark past and into the new world. Then again, there were still those who longed for the old ways, and every year, on the anniversary of Franco's death, hundreds of aging Francoists still flocked to this place to pay their respects.
Don Julian, the bishop said quietly, out of earshot of the others, as they walked deeper into the passageway. Do you know why your father summoned us here?
Julian shook his head. I was hoping you would know. Valdespino let out an unusually heavy sigh.
I don't have any idea.
If the bishop doesn't know my father's motives, Julian thought, then nobody knows them.
I just hope he's all right, the bishop said with surprising tenderness. Some of his decisions lately.
You mean like convening a meeting inside a mountain when he should be in a hospital bed? Valdespino softly smiled.
For example, yes.
Julian wondered why the king's guardia detail had not intervened and refused to bring the dying monarch out of the hospital to this foreboding location. Then again, guardia agents were trained to obey without question, especially when the request came from their commander-in-chief.
I have not prayed here in years, Valdespino said, gazing down the firelit hallway.
The tunnel through which they were moving, Julian knew, was not solely the access corridor into the mountain. It was also the nave of an officially sanctioned Catholic church. Up ahead, the prince could begin to see the rows of pews. La Basilica Secreta, Julian had called it as a child. Hollowed out of the granite mountain, the gilded sanctuary at the end of this tunnel was a cavernous space, an astonishing subterranean basilica with a massive cupola. Rumored to have more total square footage than St. Peter's in Rome, the underground mausoleum boasted six separate chapels surrounding its high altar, which was meticulously positioned directly beneath the cross atop the mountain. As they neared the main sanctuary, Julian scanned the enormous space looking for his father. The basilica, however, appeared totally deserted.
Where is he?
The bishop demanded, sounding worried. Julian now shared the bishop's concern, fearing the guardia had left the king alone in this desolate place. The prince quickly moved ahead, peering down one arm of the transept and then another. No sign of anyone. He jogged deeper, circling around the side of the altar and into the apse. It was here, in the deepest recesses of the mountain, that Julian finally spotted his father and came to an abrupt halt. The King of Spain was completely alone, covered with heavy blankets, and slumped in a wheelchair. Chapter 87. Inside the main sanctuary of the deserted chapel, Langdon and Ambra followed Winston's voice around the perimeter of the two-story supercomputer. Through the heavy glass, they heard a deep, vibrating thrum emanating from the colossal machine inside. Langdon had the eerie sense that he was peering into a cage at an incarcerated beast. The noise, according to Winston, was generated not by the electronics, but by the vast array of centrifugal fans, heat sinks, and liquid coolant pumps required to keep the machine from overheating. It's deafening in there, Winston said, and freezing. Fortunately, Edmund's lab is on the second floor. A freestanding spiral staircase rose ahead, affixed to the outer wall of the glass enclosure. On Winston's command, Langdon and Ambra climbed the stairs and found themselves standing on a metal platform before a glass revolving door. To Langdon's amusement, this futuristic entrance to Edmund's lab had been decorated as if it were a suburban home, complete with a welcome mat, a fake potted plant, and a little bench under which sat a pair of house slippers, which Langdon realized wistfully must have been Edmund's. Above the door hung a framed message. Success is the ability to go from one failure to another with no loss of enthusiasm. Winston Churchill. More Churchill, Langdon said, pointing it out to Ambra. Edmund's favorite quote, Winston chimed. He said it pinpoints the single greatest strength of computers.
Computers? Ambra asked.
Yes, computers are infinitely persistent. I can fail billions of times with no trace of frustration. I embark upon my billionth attempt at solving a problem with the same energy as my first. Humans cannot do that.
True, Langdon admitted. I usually give up after my millionth attempt.
Ambra smiled and moved toward the door. The floor inside is glass, Winston said as the revolving door began turning automatically. So please remove your shoes. Within seconds, Ambra had kicked off her shoes and stepped barefoot through the rotating portal. As Langdon followed suit, he noticed that Edmund's welcome mat bore an unusual message. There's no place like 127.0.0.1. Winston, this mat, I don't under...
Local host, Winston replied.
Langdon read the mat again. I see, he said, not seeing at all, and continued through the revolving door. When Langdon stepped out onto the glass floor, he felt a moment of weak-kneed uncertainty. Standing on a transparent surface in his socks was unnerving enough, but to find himself hovering directly over the Mare Nostrum computer downstairs felt doubly disconcerting. From up here, viewing the phalanx of stately racks below, reminded Langdon of peering down into China's famous Xi'an archaeological pit at the army of terracotta soldiers. Langdon took a deep breath and raised his eyes to the bizarre space before him. Edmund's lab was a transparent rectangle dominated by the metallic blue-gray cube he had seen earlier, its glossy surface reflecting everything around it. To the right of the cube, at one end of the room, was an ultra-sleek office space with a semicircular desk, three giant LCD screens, and assorted keyboards recessed into the granite work surface.
Mission control, Ambra whispered.
Langdon nodded and glanced toward the opposite end of the chamber where armchairs, a couch, and an exercise bike were arranged on an oriental carpet. A supercomputing man cave, Langdon mused, suspecting that Edmund had all but moved into this glass box while working on his project. What did he discover up here? Langdon's initial hesitation had passed, and he now felt the growing pull of intellectual curiosity. The yearning to learn what mysteries had been unveiled up here, what secrets had been unearthed by the collaboration of a genius mind and a powerful machine. Ambra had already padded across the floor to the massive cube and was gazing up in bewilderment at its polished blue-gray surface. Langdon joined her, both of them reflected in its shiny exterior. This is a computer? Langdon wondered. Unlike the machine downstairs, this one was dead silent, inert and lifeless. A metallic monolith. The machine's bluish hue reminded Langdon of a 1990s supercomputer called Deep Blue, which had stunned the world by defeating world chess champion Garry Kasparov. Since then, the advances in computing technology were almost impossible to comprehend. Would you like to look inside? Winston chimed from a set of speakers overhead. Ambra shot a startled glance upward.
Look inside the cube?
Why not? Winston replied. Edmund would have been proud to show you its inner workings.
Not necessary, Ambra said, turning her eyes toward Edmund's office. I'd rather focus on entering the password. How do we do that?
It will take only a matter of seconds, and we still have more than 11 minutes before we can launch. Have a look inside. Before them, a panel on the side of the cube facing Edmund's office began to slide open, revealing a thick pane of glass. Langdon and Umbra circled around and pressed their faces to the transparent portal. Langdon expected to see yet another densely packed cluster of wires and blinking lights, but he saw nothing of the sort. To his bewilderment, the inside of the cube was dark and empty, like a small, vacant room. The only contents appeared to be wisps of white mist that swirled in the air as if the room were a walk-in freezer. The thick plexiglass panel radiated a surprising coldness.
"There's nothing here," Umbra declared.
Langdon saw nothing either, but he could feel a low, repetitive pulsation emanating from within the cube. "That slow thumping beat," Winston said, "is the pulse tube dilution refrigeration system. It sounds like a human heart."
"Yes, it does," Langdon thought, unnerved by the comparison.
Slowly, red lights within began to illuminate the interior of the cube. At first, Langdon saw only white fog and bare floor space, an empty, square chamber. Then, as the glow increased, something glinted in the air above the floor, and he realized there was an intricate metal cylinder hanging down from the ceiling like a stalactite. "And this," Winston said, "is what the cube must keep cold." The cylindrical device suspended from the ceiling was about 5 feet long, composed of 7 horizontal rings that decreased in diameter as they descended, creating a narrowing column of tiered disks attached by slender vertical rods. The space between the burnished metal disks was occupied by a sparse mesh of delicate wires. An icy mist swirled around the entire device. "E-wave," Winston announced, "a quantum leap, if you'll pardon the pun, beyond NASA Google's D-wave." Winston quickly explained that D-wave, the world's first rudimentary quantum computer, had unlocked a brave new world of computational power that scientists were still struggling to comprehend. Quantum computing, rather than using a binary method of storing information, made use of the quantum states of subatomic particles, resulting in an exponential leap in speed, power, and flexibility. "Edmund's quantum computer," Winston said, "is structurally not that different from D-Wave. One difference is the metallic cube surrounding the computer. The cube is coated with osmium, a rare, ultra-dense chemical element that provides enhanced magnetic, thermal, and quantum shielding, and also, I suspect, plays into Edmund's sense of drama." Langdon smiled, having had a similar thought himself. "Over the past few years, while Google's quantum artificial intelligence lab used machines like D-Wave to enhance machine learning, Edmund secretly leapfrogged over everybody with this machine. And he did so using a single bold idea." Winston paused. "Bicameralism." Langdon frowned. "The two houses of Parliament?" "The two-lobed brain," Winston continued. "Left and right hemispheres." "The bicameral mind," Langdon now realized. One of the things that made human beings so creative was that the two halves of their brains functioned so differently. The left brain was analytical and verbal, while the right brain was intuitive and preferred pictures to words. "The trick," Winston said, "was that Edmund decided to build a synthetic brain that mimicked the human brain, that is, segmented into left and right hemispheres. Although in this case, it's more of an upstairs-downstairs arrangement." Langdon stepped back and peered through the floor at the churning machine downstairs, and then back to the silent stalactite inside the cube. Two distinct machines fused into one. A bicameral mind. "When forced to work as a single unit," Winston said, "these two machines adopt differing approaches to problem-solving, thereby experiencing the same kinds of conflict and compromise that occur between the lobes of the human brain, greatly accelerating AI learning, creativity, and, in a sense, humanity. In my case,
Edmund gave me the tools to teach myself about humanity by observing the world around me and modeling human traits, humor, cooperation, value judgments, and even a sense of ethics.
Incredible, Langdon thought.
So this double computer is essentially...
you?
Winston laughed. Well, this machine is no more me than your physical brain is you. Observing your own brain in a bowl, you would not say, that object is me. We are the sum of the interactions taking place within the mechanism.
Winston,
Umbra interjected, moving now toward Edmund's workspace.
How much time until launch?
5 minutes and 43 seconds, Winston replied. Shall we prepare?
Yes, please, she said.
The viewing window's shielding slid slowly back into place, and Langdon turned to join Umbra in Edmund's lab.
Winston, she said, considering all your work here with Edmund, I'm surprised that you have no sense at all what his discovery was.
Again, Miss Vidal, my information is compartmentalized, and I have the same data you have, he replied. I can only make an educated guess.
And what would that be?
Umbra asked, looking around Edmund's office. Well, Edmund claimed that his discovery would change everything. In my experience, the most transformative discoveries in history have all resulted in revised models of the universe. Breakthroughs like Pythagoras's rejection of the flat Earth model, Copernican heliocentrism, Darwin's theory of evolution, and Einstein's discovery of relativity, all of which drastically altered humankind's view of their world and updated our current model of the universe.
Langdon glanced up at the speaker overhead.
So you're guessing Edmund discovered something that suggests a new model of the universe?
It's a logical deduction, Winston replied, talking faster now. Mare Nostrum happens to be one of the finest modeling computers on Earth, specializing in complex simulations, its most famous being Alya Red, a fully functioning virtual human heart that is accurate down to the cellular level. Of course, with the recent addition of a quantum component, this facility can model systems millions of times more complicated than human organs.
Langdon grasped the concept, but still couldn't imagine what Edmund might have modeled to answer the questions, where do we come from, where are we going?
Winston,
Umbra called from Edmund's desk.
How do we turn all this on?
I can help you, Winston replied. The three huge LCD screens on the desk flickered to life just as Langdon arrived beside Umbra. As the images on the screen materialized, both of them stepped back in alarm.
Winston, is that image live?
Umbra asked. Yes. Live feed from our exterior security cameras. I thought you should know. They arrived several seconds ago. The display screens showed a fisheye view of the chapel's main entrance, where a small army of police had assembled, pressing the call button, trying the door, talking on radios.
Don't worry, Winston assured them. They will never get in, and we're less than 4 minutes until launch. We should launch right now, Umbra urged.
Winston replied evenly, I believe Edmund would prefer that we wait and launch at the top of the hour as promised. He was a man of his word. Moreover, I am monitoring our global viewer engagement and our audience is still growing. In the next 4 minutes, at the current rate, our audience will increase by 12.7% and, I predict, approach maximum penetration.
Winston paused, sounding almost pleasantly surprised.
I must say, despite all that has transpired this evening, it appears Edmund's release will be optimally timed. I think he would be deeply grateful to both of you.
Chapter 88 Under 4 minutes, Langdon thought, lowering himself into Edmund's mesh desk chair and turning his eyes to the three huge LCD panels that dominated this end of the room. On screen, the live security feeds still played, showing police gathering around the chapel.
You're sure they can't get in?
Umbra urged, shifting anxiously behind Langdon.
Trust me, Winston replied. Edmund took security very seriously.
And if they cut power to the building? Langdon ventured.
Isolated power supply, Winston replied flatly. Redundant buried trunks. Nobody can interfere at this point, I assure you.
Langdon let it go. Winston has been correct on all fronts tonight, and he's had our backs the whole way. Settling in at the center of the horseshoe-shaped desk, Langdon turned his attention to the unusual keyboard before him. It had at least twice the normal number of keys, traditional alphanumerics augmented by an array of symbols that even he didn't recognize. The keyboard was split down the middle, each half ergonomically angled away from the other.
Some guidance here? Langdon asked, staring at the bewildering array of keys.
Wrong keyboard, Winston replied. That's E-Wave's main access point. As I mentioned, Edmund kept this presentation hidden from everyone, including me. The presentation must be triggered from a different machine. Slide to your right, all the way to the end.
Langdon glanced to his right, where a half-dozen freestanding computers were aligned along the length of the desk. As he rolled toward them, he was surprised to see that the first few machines were quite old and outdated. Strangely, the farther he rolled, the older the machines seemed to get.
This can't be right, he thought, passing a clunky-looking beige IBM DOS system that had to be decades old.
Winston, what are these machines?
Edmund's childhood computers, Winston said. He kept them as a reminder of his roots. Sometimes, on difficult days here, he would power them up and run old programs, a way to reconnect with the wonder he felt as a boy when he discovered programming.
I love that idea, Langdon said.
Just like your Mickey Mouse watch, Winston said.
Startled, Langdon glanced down, pulling back the sleeve of his suit jacket to reveal the antique timepiece he had worn since he had received it as a boy. That Winston knew about his watch was surprising, although Langdon recalled telling Edmund recently about wearing it as a reminder to stay young at heart.
Robert, Umbra said, your fashion sense aside, could we please enter the password? Even your mouse is waving, trying to get your attention.
Sure enough, Mickey's gloved hand was high over his head, his index finger pointing almost straight up. 3 minutes till the hour. Langdon quickly slid along the desk, and Umbra joined him at the last computer in the series, an ungainly, mushroom-colored box with a floppy disk slot, a 1200-baud telephone modem, and a bulbous, 12-inch convex monitor sitting on top.
Tandy TRS-80, Winston said. Edmund's first machine. He bought it used and taught himself basic when he was about 8 years old.
Langdon was happy to see that this computer, despite being a dinosaur, was already turned on and waiting. Its screen, a flickering black and white display, glowed with a promising message, spelled out in a jagged bitmapped font. Welcome, Edmund. Please enter password. After the word password, a black cursor blinked expectantly.
That's it? Langdon asked, feeling somehow like it was all too simple. I just enter it here?
Exactly, Winston replied. Once you enter the password, this PC will send an authenticated unlock message to the sealed partition in the main computer that contains Edmund's presentation. I will then have access and be able to manage the feed, align it with the top of the hour, and push the data to all the main distribution channels for global relay.
Langdon more or less followed the explanation. And yet, as he stared down at the clunky computer and telephone modem, he felt perplexed.
I don't understand, Winston. After all of Edmund's planning tonight, why would he ever trust his entire presentation to a phone call to a prehistoric modem?
I would say that's just Edmund being Edmund, Winston replied. As you know, he was passionate about drama, symbolism, and history, and I suspect it brought him enormous joy to power up his very first computer and use it to launch his life's greatest work.
Fair point, Langdon reflected, realizing that was exactly how Edmund would have seen it.
Moreover, Winston added, I suspect Edmund probably had contingencies in place, but either way, there's logic to using an ancient computer to throw a switch. Simple tasks require simple tools. And security-wise, using a slow processor ensures that a brute force hacking of the system would take forever.
Robert?
Umbra urged behind him, giving his shoulder an encouraging squeeze.
Yes, sorry. All set.
Langdon pulled the Tandy keyboard closer to him, its tightly coiled cable stretching out like an old rotary phone cord. He laid his fingers on the plastic keys and pictured the line of handwritten text that he and Umbra had discovered in the crypt at Sagrada Familia. The dark religions are departed, and sweet science reigns. The grand finale of William Blake's epic poem, The Four Zoas, seemed the perfect choice to unlock Edmund's final scientific revelation, a discovery he claimed would change everything. Langdon took a deep breath and carefully typed in the line of poetry with no spaces and replaced the ampersand with the ligature ET. When he finished, he looked up at the screen. Please enter password. Langdon counted the dots. 47. Perfect. Here goes nothing. Langdon made eye contact with Umbra, and she gave him a nod. He reached out and hit the return key. Instantly, the computer emitted a dull buzz. Incorrect password. Try again. Langdon's heart thundered.
Umbra, I typed it perfectly. I'm sure of it.
He spun in his chair and looked up at her, fully expecting to see her face filled with fear. Instead, Umbra Vidal stared down at him with an amused smile. She shook her head and laughed.
Professor, she whispered, pointing to his keyboard, your caps lock is on.
At that moment, deep inside a mountain, Prince Julian stood transfixed, staring across the subterranean basilica, trying to make sense of the baffling scene before him. His father, the King of Spain, sat motionless in a wheelchair, parked in the most remote and private section of this basilica. With a surge of dread, Julian rushed to his side.
Father?
As Julian arrived, the king slowly opened his eyes, apparently emerging from a nap. The ailing monarch managed a relaxed smile.
Thank you for coming, son,
he whispered, his voice frail. Julian crouched down in front of the wheelchair, relieved that his father was alive, but also alarmed at how dramatically the man had deteriorated in just a few days.
Father, are you okay?
The king shrugged.
As well as can be expected, he replied with surprisingly good humor. How are you? Your day has been eventful.
Julian had no idea how to reply.
What are you doing here?
Well, I was tired of the hospital and wanted some air.
Fine, but here?
Julian knew his father had always abhorred this shrine's symbolic link to persecution and intolerance.
Your Majesty, called Valdespino,
hurrying around the altar and joining them, breathless.
What in the world?
The king smiled at his lifelong friend.
Antonio, welcome.
Antonio? Prince Julian had never heard his father address Bishop Valdespino by his first name. In public, it was always, Your Excellency. The king's uncharacteristic lack of formality seemed to rattle the bishop.
Thank you, he stammered. Are you okay?
Simply wonderful,
the king replied, smiling broadly.
I'm in the presence of the two people I trust most in the world.
Valdespino shot an uneasy glance at Julian and then turned back to the king.
Your Majesty, I've delivered your son to you as you requested. Shall I leave you two to talk in private?
No, Antonio, the king said. This will be a confession, and I need my priest at my side.
Valdespino shook his head. I don't think your son